Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 27th, 2011. And a lot of very interesting things have happened in this past week. I'll hope to be recounting as many as I can in this hour, which seems to go by very quickly. Commercial free, by the way. First of all, as many of you listen to my show on the archive on the webpage, on my jmccannyscience.com webpage, and you probably have noticed that it wasn't the archive from last week's show was not there this week. Well, I'll just tell a little bit about what happened. Last week, I did the show in a remote location, and it ran very well. The signal was fine. Everything worked exactly as it should have. And then I recorded the show digitally, so then I could post it on the webpage. So that was fine. Many hours later, when I finally was able to get to an internet connection where I could process the show and move it up to the web page, I was immediately hit by, I call it cyber bombing, and basically has taken this whole week to recover. So if you, say, wrote an email and didn't hear back or something like that, that's basically what happened. I then looked into this. The things that happened to my computer were very strange, but luckily I was able to recover. I then found out that across the entire country there was a barrage of infestations, I should say, of computers. And through my own research, the only thing I could find out is that WebRoot, in many cases, was completely corrupted. Many times by old, what appeared to be old viruses or what were determined to be old viruses. WebRoot is a so-called a security program for computers, and it appeared that then when people came in and complained, they said, well, you didn't have the Max version of WebRoot. I don't really... this is all, to me, hocus pocus. It's all a big game. And so it's an industry that's grown around an industry, the old protection racket, so to speak. And so I really don't like any of this. All of this could be avoided. The main reason computers get infected is because the government forced computer software writers to leave gaping holes in their software. Why should an email coming in or some other form of input into your computer from outside all of a sudden take over your computer? And everybody wants to own your computer. You have things popping up all over on your computer. This is absolutely absurd. You don't even know what's in your computer anymore. And so at any rate, but to get back to the show, this show should go up very quickly after the live presentation. Just a quick notice here. This is a note from WWCR. This is the shortwave station broadcasting right now. And you're listening on a frequency. That will change starting next week's show. I will be moving to the wintertime frequency, 5.070, so make a note of that. Next week, my show will be airing on 5070 from WWCR. This does not, I repeat, it does not affect the frequencies or the times of the Friday night and Saturday morning airing of this show. So at any rate, Thursday evening, starting next week, make a note of this. The frequency will change to the wintertime frequency, 5.070. Same time, same station. So at any rate, I'll post that on my webpage also so that people are aware of that. Well, let's see. Where do I start here with this week's announcements? The main science topic, I actually have two. I'll be talking about the barrage of information that's coming your way about what I call fairy tale science, the science that just is pawned off on the public. There are TV specials, Scientific America, Discover Magazine. There's just an absolute barrage of garbage science being pawned off on the public. And I don't know, whenever you see this, it's called complete coverage. In other words, every place you go, you're going to be seeing this. Every magazine you open, you're going to be seeing advertisements for this, promoting dark matter, for example. Anyway, my show is going to be explaining why the dark matter concepts are just really ridiculous, but standard science keeps pushing these. In a nutshell, what happened about 40 years ago or longer, scientists started to realize that the data they were seeing in galaxies and in the cosmos, in the greater cosmos, that they didn't add up. The velocities of stars in the galaxy, etc., didn't make any sense if you looked at Newtonian or gravitational physics. So they said something else is going on. So what they invented was dark matter. And they said, well, there's got to be some other matter in here that we can't see that's causing these velocity curves to be skewed. But then the physics got goofy. Let's just put it that way. Let's take an example. The Earth is moving around the Sun. We're at a certain distance from the Sun. The Sun has a certain mass. And so according to Newtonian mechanics, celestial mechanics, you can calculate what the Earth's velocity should be. And we, in fact, have the correct velocity for our distance from the Sun, given the mass of the Sun, etc. But in the galaxies, this is not the case. The farther you get away from the nucleus of the galaxy, the star velocity curves don't add up. So what do scientists do? Instead of saying, well, there's got to be something else going on here, they assume that the stars are moving in circular orbits around the Sun, or the center of the galaxy. And that's their mistake. That is a big mistake, and that's what I showed in some of my very early papers, that the assumption that stars move in circular orbits around the galactic center is an incorrect assumption. And something else very different is going on, and it's that simple. But what do they do? Astronomers then say, by the way, I keep saying this, astronomers, many astronomers are not good physicists. They do not have good physics training. So they insert a tremendous amount of matter in mass in the galaxy and say, well, if we put this amount of matter in the galaxy, then our velocity curves will work out just great. The only problem is we can't find that matter. It doesn't exhibit any properties. But they forget, they go off on this tangent, never realizing that the amount of matter they have to insert, this invisible magic matter, is far more matter than the mass of the galactic nucleus. An impossible celestial mechanics situation. But they never come back. They go off onto a tangent. So we have all of this incredible, expensive equipment and fleets of PhD scientists searching for something called dark matter. And they have gone off on this tangent so long that they can't come back. Now they're pawning this off on the public. So the cover of the October issue of Scientific American magazine, the November issue of Discover magazine, have all over the cover dark matter, the search for dark matter, and the most intelligent people in the world are looking for this dark matter. I would say just the opposite. The people who are completely crawling down the wrong road, using up our international resources for science, are crawling down the wrong road looking for something that doesn't exist. Truly a wild goose chase. and looking for, like I say, something that simply doesn't exist. Instead of throwing out their beloved concept that stars move in circular orbits around the galactic center. It's just that simple. But anyway, I'll be talking more about that. Let me go into a couple other topics here. This you will be bombarded by. More fairy tale science. There's a series of programs coming up. It's called Fabric of the Cosmos, and this is coming up. I'm not advertising this. I'm just telling you that you will probably not be able to open up a newspaper or a television programming guide or whatever without seeing this plastered all over in front of you. And it's to bring what I call, you know, ridiculous fairy tale science to the public. The public needs to be educated in basic science before it's given, gee whiz, isn't that amazing science? And I get a kick out of the producer of this show. Her name is Paula Epsel. She says, our viewers love ideas. The bigger, the better. So let's just throw giant, big, ridiculous, pie-in-the-sky ideas out to them in gee whiz them and wow them with all of this amazing with special effects on this four-part TV series, but there's really no science there. There's no science. There's no proof that there are parallel universes, that there is time travel, that the time that you're living in now could be visited from another time. There's no proof of any of this. I mean, they're nice thoughts. But science is science. If you're going to present it as science, then you need data. You need applicable, this has to be applied. There has to be some practical experiment that can show this in your neck of the woods, in my neck of the woods, in Russia, in Europe, in South America, in Africa. But there is none. It's just pie in the sky. Like I say, fairy tale science, but this is what's being pawned off on the public. Gee whiz science for the public, and the real scientific issues of the day are simply being ignored. So, at any rate, be prepared for that. I really, I liken this kind of to the Cosmos series that occurred, although that, I believe, was many, many more parts. I think it was close to a dozen parts, the old Cosmos series with Carl Sagan, but this Nova series is very much along the same line. You get a star of the astronomical or physics community and present all of these amazing ideas. And it certainly would be nice to have a show like this. You'd certainly sell a lot of books, but the end result is that, like I say, fairy tale science for the public. And the real scientific issues, like comets hitting the sun and causing tremendous flaring, is completely put aside. At any rate, it also is a way for science to get the public revved up about contributing so that NASA keeps getting its paycheck, that the flow of funding into these meaningless projects keeps moving, and real science gets suppressed. That's the end result. Okay, so this past week, another country fell to the free trade agreement. I don't know if you'd call it a scam. But basically, here's what happens, and I've read many, many articles about the philosophy of so-called free trade, and the benefits towards society or countries or industries, etc. But the reality is, the basic fundamental reality is it turns entire countries of laborers into slaves. This past week, a little South American country called Colombia changed, passed the Free Trade Act and with the United States. But what does that do to the people of that country? Well, it opens up the resources of the country to multinationalists who've been sharpening their blades for oil, natural gas, iron, other resources. it puts the people in that country all of a sudden, in a blink of an eye, competing with the labor of the Chinese, of Korea, of the Asian third world countries. All of a sudden, these people are going to be competing at labor values that will keep them basically in slavery. What would happen to a country like that if they refused to join into a free trade act? Well, they would eventually be squeezed out of the economic world because they couldn't compete against China. So it's a catch-22. It's like a game of chess. You know, a game of chess where, say, you're playing with someone and one of the players has quite a few moves ahead of the other person. No matter what move that person makes, checkmate. The term is that your king is now in checkmate. And so the person, if they move one of their pieces this way or that way, no matter which way they move, checkmate, they lose. And that's the situation with free trade. If a country refuses, they are doomed to economic disaster because they cannot compete on a world market with countries like China that is fueling the manufacturing manpower for a country like the United States. The United States is crumbling before your very eyes. This all started many years ago. The first free trade in studying this phenomenon, 1965 was when the United States and Mexico and Canada began negotiating for free trade. And of course, there were a lot of people opposing it, but it's the kind of thing that once it gets going, you can't stop it. You cannot stop this. Because the other countries are going to pass it, and the United States goes along with it. The entire purpose of free trade was to bring the United States down to the level of a third world country. And that's where we are right now. We're on the brink of being a third world country. So the once again, these small countries, the size of maybe four or five states of the United States, or maybe even smaller, they're in a checkmate situation. If they do, their people become slaves. If they don't, their people cannot compete on a worldwide market. If you've noticed, the price of commodities has not gone down. So someone in the middle, including shipping, is making a lot of money off free trade. There are good aspects to free trade and bad aspects, but the overall end result is complete domination by a small group of international corporations and bankers, and the end result is enslavery of the world population under a one-world economic umbrella. So at any rate, let me make a quick note here about Jupiter. Last week, my show, I talked about the Jupiter winds. And so if you did not get a chance to hear the show last week and you didn't catch the archive, make sure that once the archive is up there that you do listen to that show. It's a very, very important show. But this past week, the Comet Elenin people were still out trying to do their YouTube videos and the world is going to end and people giving dates and telling you that Comet Elenin, I don't know what all. I really didn't listen to all the goofy, ridiculous things. But I noticed that they were there. So tonight, in fact, is the actual visual alignment of Jupiter with Earth. But as I said last week, the electrical alignment with Jupiter has been going on for some time. And so that has affected our weather in the relationship to Jupiter and winds. So I called them the winds of Jupiter. I coined that term last week. But no, it's not the end of the world. Comet Elenin, nope, is not going to cause the end of the world. And if anything, Jupiter might cause a little bit of a electrical alignment with Elenin, make it brighten just a little bit. But basically the issue of Comet Elenin is over. It's a past thing. Nothing ever happened, just like I said. And it's important to dwell on this a little bit, because the issue is that, why did Comet Elenin become such a big internet issue? Well, this was promoted by the disinformation crew. It was not just a bunch of loony people out there decided one day to make a bunch of YouTube videos and take a little nothing comet and make it into a big internet colossal information or misinformation campaign. No, this was developed long ago. It came out in about January of this year, and it was very well coordinated, so that at a certain point the NASA white hats could come in to save the day. It made a big effort at destroying my name and my work, which, as you can tell, didn't happen. And so a lot of that backfired, as usually does happen with the disinformation crew. It probably woke a lot of people up to what the disinformation crew is all about, and really exposed them for who they are. So, as I said many times, the when people wake up and they see, why is someone putting this much effort into total misinformation to mislead the public, now you can start to research. And a lot of new people ended up at my webpage, starting to understand what misinformation is, what the government is trying to do with this information, how they are trying to hoodwink the public. And in the end, I gain a lot of new listeners, a lot of people who listened to me all along. At first they thought maybe Comet Elenin, that would be the end of the world. But when I was consistent in telling them that no, this was a nothing comet, but this was a big misinformation campaign, there's a lot of people that gained an insight into the misinformation world. And so that woke them up to think, well, why is this tremendous amount of misinformation being put out there? So for that reason, I think it's good, because every time the misinformation crew tries to do something, they end up kind of stepping all over themselves, and they actually end up educating some people or bringing some people to the table where they can be educated. So at any rate, tonight is the visual alignment of Jupiter and Earth. But as I said, the electrical alignment, which is the plasma alignment, has been going on for some time and will continue for some time to come. So we could get some fairly significant weather situations. Along that same line, this past week, October 21st, another comet coming in from the south, coming in, and once again, NASA pulls the feed right at the critical time when the comet comes in towards the sun. And snap, boom, comes off this big, immense solar flare. 3 days later, that flare hits Earth, causing auroras that reach down to the southern states of the United States, as far south as Alabama. And so I want to clarify something here. I use the term loosely, a comet hitting the sun, because the real electricity, the activity that snaps the sun into a major solar flaring, that occurs way before the comet ever gets to the sun. It's action at a distance. The comet is discharging the solar capacitor. And at a certain point, it's like a spark plug. Boom! And this is way before the comet nucleus ever gets to the sun. And so I call it action at a distance, and it's the type of thing that if we have a comet that's really affecting the sun, the comet doesn't have to come near Earth. The sun, of course, is not near Earth, but the effects, the weather effects, the aurora effects, the space weather effects can be very pronounced for planet Earth. So the scenario, once again, October 21st, comet comes in from the south and comes near the sun, actually comes in, hits the sun, disintegrates near the sun. But bang, out comes this tremendous solar flare. 3 days later, we have auroras going as far south as Alabama, and the standard science community has their telescopes off looking for dark matter. What's wrong with this picture? At any rate, just wanted to mention that. Let's see, what else? I'm going to look through some of my notes here. And that was interesting also, that exactly when that comet came in to strike the sun, NASA pulls the feed again from the SOHO satellite. Now, I noticed just before, in preparing for the show, that NASA on the SOHO webpage, SOHO is the Solar Observatory Heliospheric Observatory, they keep saying that no comet has ever been recorded hitting the sun. And that is exactly incorrect, because right after the October 3rd comet hitting the sun, that's the one I made a great big to-do about, because that I announced on the Coast to Coast show that Friday evening. By Saturday, or shortly after that, NASA had pulled the feeds off all of the satellites, so we couldn't see the explosive activity. Spaceweather.com hid the data, tried to make it pretend like, oh, there was some flaring, but no big deal, only to find out later that some of the biggest, most incredible flares ever to come out of the sun had occurred as that comet came in. Then there were all kinds of apologetic articles coming out of the NASA spin machine and trying to say that, well, no, comets could not possibly do that, because, of course, they're just little dirty snowballs, so how could a comet possibly do that? End of story. Well, as I said, now NASA is claiming that a comet hitting the sun has never been directly observed, because the SOHO cameras only see it in so far, and then it's blotted out by the central disks that block out the light from the sun. Well, that statement is simply incorrect, because the stereo A and B satellites saw that particular comet of October 3rd and saw it all the way into the surface of the sun. Something that I'm sure they don't want to talk about, because little snowballs really wouldn't last that long. The conditions next to the sun, right at the surface of the sun, are so incredibly intense and hot, and the solar wind, all of these conditions are so immense that a little snowball wouldn't last a New York second. But here it is, here's this comet, and it's winding its way, you can see the comet path all the way in through that solar inferno, all the way to the surface of the sun, something that would be absolutely impossible. So they try and pretend now, basically lying, saying that such an event has never been recorded. Let's see. Okay, just looking through the notes. Okay, I'm going to start in, I have two topics I want to talk about, the main science topic tonight. First of all, it's been a while since I've talked about any health issues. And I know a lot of people out there today, we're all trying to just survive, just trying to make it through the week in a lot of cases. And there's a lot of stress, things like that. But something, I had somewhat of a life-altering event this past week, nothing major, some realizations that I'm not going to be real specific where these came from, but I want to talk about your spinal column, your backbone. A lot of people have problems with their back. In fact, it's probably safe to say that just about everybody that you know, including yourself, has a problem with your backbone. Many of you don't know it. You look at people with posture. How many people do you know that have what you would call perfect posture? The backbone is a very, physically, it's a very complex piece of machinery. But the one thing that it does, or attempts to do, is to guide the nervous system and protect the nervous system, the signals that come from your brain and are distributed throughout your body, are protected by your backbone, and then out the little holes in the side of the backbone come the nerves that feed all of our organs, all of our muscles, all of our entire body. Every cell has a connection back to the main nervous system. And these are all controlled literally from your brain. Now, the point is that the backbone in most people has some problems. By the time you're 20 or 30 years old, you probably had an injury, you've probably sat wrong, you probably have poor posture, a hundred different things that can affect your backbone, but the end result is that your backbone is skewed, it's twisted, it's bent, it's out of alignment, and the end result after that is the signals that go to the rest of your body are short-circuited, basically. So when a lot of people have what they call chronic disease, or they have heart disease, there's all types of names for these medical conditions. What happens when you go to a medical doctor? Well, they go, well, gee, you have chronic heart disease. Well, your heart replaces all of its cells every 6 months. So if you had some little problem with your heart, it should be replacing all of those cells every 6 months. They're constantly being replenished, but on average, at the end of 6 month period, your heart is completely a complete new set of cells than what it was 6 months ago. So if you have a chronic problem with your heart, then there's something causing this. So what does the medical doctor do? They say, well, we can operate. We'll cut you open, put a pig's heart in there, or they give you pills. And what do the pills do? Well, they simply mask the problem. They don't cure anything. And so now you say, okay, well, my pain has gone away. My blood is flowing again. It must have. Now you have to be on this medication. So the point is that the real cause of the problem, the fact that your spinal column is blocking signals to that area, the real cause of the problem is not being addressed in standard medical science. There was an interesting fact that I heard, and that is that before you start feeling pain or discomfort or a problem with your physical, one of your physical systems, say a kidney or a prostate or a lungs or say the lymphatic system in your neck, or headaches, go down the laundry list, pain in your lower legs, poor circulation. Before you notice anything is wrong, you have already lost 40% of the function in that particular set of organs or muscles or whatever. So you're already on your way to pretty poor health. Now, why am I including this in this show? The reason is because we really are living in a medical system, the American medical system, that is really, really bad for. It does not bring us good health. It only puts masks, 99% of the time, it only puts masks or tries to cut out the problem once a chronic condition exists. But in the vast majority of cases, the problem is not being resolved because the problem stems back to a very simple fact that signals are not getting to that set of organs or muscles or cells or whatever in your body. And your body is meant to maintain itself in good health. And that's why when people get older, their lifestyle changes, they're more sedentary, their eating habits become very dysfunctional. A lot of older people have very poor diets. You look at the American grocery store, everything is in boxes or nice labeled packages, but it's not food. it's processed food. There's really no food value, so what do? They put sugar, they put spices. They put things in there that are terrible for you, that they create an overload of acidic chemicals in your body. And so as people get older, they get so they, the other day I was just, I've started looking at people. I was in a parking lot and looking at people getting out of cars. The majority of people I saw could hardly get out of their vehicle and stand up. This is the American way of life now. This is standard. Obesity in this country has reached 60%. 60% of people are overweight. And so you look at the chronic problems that are developing, and just imagine all of the backbones out there that are not that are being blocked. The signals are not getting out into the person's body to cure itself, to maintain health. Why am I talking about this? Anyway, it's a topic that I'll probably be covering a little bit every show, and I think it's just important for people to start to wake up as to what is health and how do you maintain that health. At any rate, I'll be talking about that possibly a bit more in the future. Tonight's main science topic, I want to talk about galaxies and cosmology. And so to do that, I have to step back a little bit, and as opposed to the shows that you might see on television or the Gee Whiz specials, I want to talk about some very fundamental science. If you take an atom over here, and you take an atom in your right hand, take an atom in your left hand, and hold them out in front of you about a foot apart. Okay, then look at the forces between those two atoms. If the atoms are neutral, in other words, there's the same number of electrons around the nucleus as there are protons in the nucleus, then those atoms are neutral, and the electrons shield the protons in the nucleus. There are no electrical forces, so the only force available is gravity, the force of gravity. That could pull those two atoms together. Now, at that distance, the force between two atoms is very weak. And so if you take a galactic amount of matter, then there are measurable forces involved, the forces that would hold that galaxy together. So if you have there's some rules of plasma in outer space that if you have, say, one of those atoms there, say you remove an electron from that one of the atoms, all of a sudden it's charged. Okay, well, that's great. If the other atom in your left hand then is not ionized, then the atom in your right hand, if it's ionized or charged, is still not going to have any major effect on the one in your left hand. Because you need two charges to cause electrical effects. And so, at any rate, these are just some basic physics concepts. Now, if you look out into the far reaches of the galaxy, let's take that one atom that's ionized and put it out in the middle of a galaxy. What's going to happen to that? Is charged? Aren't there going to be great electrical effects? Electrical effects are much more powerful, much more, the forces involved are much greater. Well, what's going to happen since you're in free space? Immediately, any charges of the opposite sign that are nearby are going to come over, and they're going to try and neutralize that charge. So, at any rate, space is full of free electrons. So if you remove an electron from an atom, it's not going to be long till some other electron is going to whip in there and try and neutralize that atom. Likewise, if you have any charged object the size of Jupiter, let's say. Say that Jupiter were a charged object, and it was out in outer space. What's going to happen very quickly? Well, very quickly, any charge of the opposite polarity is going to quickly move in around Jupiter, and it's going to neutralize the charge on Jupiter. In other words, Jupiter is not going to remain charged for very long. So in the now, I'm going to talk tonight solely about gravitational systems. Of course, my work with comets shows that the Sun is a vast charge-separating engine, that the fusion in the Sun's surface separates charge. It blows the protons out in greater numbers and greater velocities than the electrons. It causes a big battery. So Jupiter, Earth, all the comets, all of the asteroids, all of the planets, all of the moons are discharging that solar capacitor. That causes some very special effects. It causes Jupiter to maintain a charge where it normally would not. That's because it's sitting in the non-uniform electric field of the Sun. If the Sun stopped pouring out that non-uniform charge distribution, Jupiter would not remain charged for very long. But at any rate, once you get out into intergalactic space, gravity really is the ruling, dominating force. There are electrical things going on, but there's a little quirk of physics, something that I explain in my very early comet papers, that the surface area around a planet or a moon or something large, some large physical object in the universe, that the surface area is relatively small relative to the volume and mass of the object. So say that Jupiter has a surface charge. Okay, and you can maintain that, let's say that. How does that compare, the charge to mass ratio of a charged Jupiter, how does that compare to the charge to mass ratio of an electron, something that's microscopically small compared to a big planet like Jupiter? And it turns out that the charge to mass ratio, the amount of charge for the amount of mass in an electron, is a very, very big number, which means that the electron is very much affected by its charge. And the mass of the electron really doesn't have a lot to do with what happens to that electron. But in the case of Jupiter or anything down to the size of a baseball, if you have a charge on that object in outer space, then the charge to mass ratio is extremely small. In other words, the effect of that charge to move that thing around or make something happen is negligible, because there the mass dominates. It's a very quirky little principle. It's something that I identified, and so that causes some very strange situations in outer space. But the point is that if we look at the motion of Jupiter, Jupiter can have all of the electrical charge on it at once, but it won't be measurable in terms of its celestial mechanics. The things that make Jupiter move, the things that keep Jupiter in its orbit around the Sun, are strictly gravitational. Whereas if you look at something like an electron or a proton or a molecule of water or a molecule of oil that's ionized, all of a sudden those objects do have a great effect if they are electrically charged. Their charge-to-mass ratio is relatively high, therefore the electrical part of their existence has a tremendous effect on their motion. So at any rate, when you move out into the galaxy and you start talking about galactic centers and stars moving, you're talking about a gravitational system. You can imagine all the charge you want and all the electrical effects you want, but in terms of motion, you're strictly dealing with gravity. So, and I have to say this too, there's a lot of quacks running around the internet that have no idea about what they're talking about in terms of electricity, in terms of electricity in outer space. And there's a lot of people in standard science who are, I would put in the quack category too, because they don't understand. But the bottom line is that when you're dealing with a galaxy, it is strictly gravitational. You have to understand the motion, the activity of the galaxy, and the measurement of velocities of stars in the galaxy. All of that has to be controlled by gravitational and gravitational forces only. So now we enter the recent barrage of public information going out. As I said, Scientific American, the October issue, has a big article, Warped by Dark Matter, Strange Effects on the Milky Way, trying to tell you that dark matter is causing the Milky Way galaxy, our own galaxy, to warp. What a strange thing. But the thing that's even stranger is that scientists, after searching for decades and decades, can't seem to identify, locate, or find this dark matter. That's very strange. With all of the equipment they've been using and all of the national funding and all of the new papers published in scientific peer-reviewed journals, they have never found a drop of dark matter. In all of the accelerators, the high-energy physics that is being done, nobody has ever found a single piece or drop or atom or whatever of dark matter. Yet they claim that 85% of the universe is filled with this stuff. Wouldn't that make you go back and rethink your basic theories? That would make me do that. So I experienced this when I was out at Cornell, 1979 to 81. I remember meeting a guy named Ed Saltpeter in the hall one day. He's a physicist, an astrophysicist who worked at Cornell. I believe he's now deceased. And I said, Ed, this concept of missing mass is what they called it at the time, to make a galaxy velocity curves come out according to the data, I said it can't be true. How can you have more matter that you can't see orbiting the nucleus in like 10 times the amount of matter? This is not the way that celestial mechanics works. And he got real huffy with me, and it was like he did not want to hear that. This was not something in his vocabulary. It's not something he wanted to hear about. And so all of the people that got PhDs in that epoch, in that time frame, are out there now giving PhDs to the new crop of physicists coming in, all of them for 30, 40 years looking for dark matter, or this missing mass, whatever you want to call it. The Milky Way galaxy, if you look at the dust clouds around the Milky Way galaxy, they are offset from the central plane by quite a bit. Well, is there something else that could possibly be causing that? There's another effect in galaxies. When astronomers look out into the billions of galaxies that we see around the universe and you measure what are called the velocity curves. Okay, there's a galaxy. You're looking at it. It's that pinwheel-looking structure. There's billions of stars in it. It's 100,000 light years across or more, some of them bigger, some of them smaller. And you, with a telescope, you look at the red shifts and the blue shifts of the stars whipping around the outside, and you look at the velocity based on the red shift of the stars as they move out, as you look at the stars radially out away from the center of the galaxy. And when you plot the velocities that you read, these are physical readings done by telescopes using special relativity, you see that the blue curves, the blue shifted curves, the stars coming at you, have a certain velocity field, and the ones moving away from you, the red shifted stars, have a somewhat opposite set of velocity distribution. But they're very much the same, the ones coming at you. Now, here's the problem. In a real spherical orbit, the farther away you get from the central object, the slower the object moves. So let's take Earth moving around the Sun. It moves at a certain velocity in its orbit around the Sun, relatively circular. If you took Earth and moved it out an equal distance farther from the Sun and put it in an orbit so it was balanced in a nice circular orbit, it would move much slower than it currently moves. The velocity of Earth would be much slower. It's going to take a lot longer to get around the Sun in that distant orbit. If you took it out 3 times farther, it would move even slower. 4 times farther, it would move even slower. Gravitational physics predicts the velocity, and all of the planets in our solar system follow this law very nicely. So we're very comfortable with it. But if you go out into the world of galaxies, looking at stars moving around the central galactic plane, and the central point, the central pivotal galactic nucleus, the stars don't move when you measure their velocities using light curves and red shifts and blue shifts. The stars are not moving according to Newtonian physics. So as I said earlier, the solution, physicists put a tremendous amount of dark matter, unseen matter, somewhere out in the central part of that galaxy in big disks. And they say, if we do this, now the stars farther out have much more mass in the center. Therefore, they're going to move much faster. I guess that was a factor I forgot to mention. Now, let's go back to the Earth example. Earth moving around the Sun. If we doubled the mass of the Sun, Earth would move in its orbit much faster to keep in this same circular orbit. So these are the factors that control what we call the velocity curves of stars or planets around the stars or stars around the galactic center. So what astronomers then do is they say, okay, if we put all of this matter, it's imaginary matter, out in the galaxy, out in the arms, away from the nucleus, then our velocity curves would add up. They would be correct with gravitational Newtonian physics, and life is good again. The only problem is they can't find any of the matter that they're talking about. In fact, it takes about 85% of the matter of the galaxy to be in this invisible form. Unfortunately, also, when you find vast accumulations of matter, they tend to be consolidate very quickly, and according to standard astronomical theory, these should form stars very quickly and be bright. So you have the matter that should form the brightest part of the galaxy totally invisible. How does that work? Nobody seems to want to talk about that little fact. Let's talk about the warped galaxies. Galaxies, sometimes they look like a record disc plane, like in a plane, but they're warped up on one side. But the very interesting thing is that they're warped on the other side of the galaxy in exactly the opposite direction. So imagine a record disc that is warped up on one side and warped down on the other. How does that happen? How 100,000 light years away does the arm on the left side happen to know what the arm on the right side is doing? Well, of course, there again, fairy tale science would tell you that, a galaxy flew by and caused this warpage. Well, first of all, you can't find the galaxy that flew by. So then you have to say, well, the galaxy that flew by is made out of dark matter and we can't see it. But then you have the more difficult question to answer. How did a galaxy fly by the left side exactly the same way as it flew by the right side, but down below on the left side and up above on the right side? Boy, that's a that's quite a coincidence. And it's even more of a coincidence when it happens billions of times. So clearly something else is going on here. So as far back as, like I say, the late 1970s, I realized that there's something had to be fundamentally wrong with the galactic model that assumed that stars go around in circles. So I developed a model that said, well, clearly, if the material is falling in to the galactic center, it spirals in. What's going to happen to it? It's going to become very hot, very compressed, and it's going to become a fluid. And as that fluid becomes superheated and pressure from the outside keeps pushing in and more matter keeps falling into the galactic nucleus and spinning in, out of the two sides are going to come the spiral arms, and they're going to come shooting out the two different sides. Why only two arms? Why not three? Why not five? Why not seven? Well, it turns out that in a fluid flow problem, the most efficient way to get the molten matter out of the galactic nucleus area, the most efficient matter, the most efficient number of flows coming out is two, one on each side, balanced, exactly coming out the same side. So imagine that the infalling matter all of a sudden changed its rotational plane. Now the two arms coming out are going to be skewed from the original arms coming out. That's where the warpage occurs, and as that arm moves out, the orbits of these stars move out, then you would find that the earlier stars are moving out in one plane, the later stars are moving out in another plane, causing the warpage of the disk. And it's going to be equal and opposite on the two sides of the galaxy. All of this explained by a very simple model, which I called continuing galactic evolution. And what's further is that when you look at the velocity curves of the orbits of these stars moving out, they now fit nicely with the data. So when the scientists are running around like chickens with their head cut off looking for dark matter, this is what I call fairy tale science. They're pounding a square peg into a round hole, or vice versa. But the unfortunate part is this is what is being pounded down the throat of the public. Fairy tale science. And like I say, this is the cover of Scientific American magazine, October 2011. We're talking about a 30-year span here when science has made absolutely no progress. They're still looking for dark matter, the missing mass, and nobody has found it. And never will. And this is going to go on for another 10, 20 years. But what's the end result? Fairy tale science. This keeps the public stupid, keeps real science from happening, and keeps the real important issues of science away from the public. Just a quick note here before I'm off the air. Remember to visit the website. The water filter is something that everybody needs, jmccsci.com, and the new 2-CD set. Let me quickly give out the mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392, P.O. Box 58. And just remember to order the 2-CD set at $17 for one set or $24 for two sets. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroad. Good night.